I'm Matt Schmucker, Executive Director of Nine Marks. We believe the local church is the focal point of God's plan for displaying His glory to the nations. Our vision is simple: churches that reflect the character of God. To that end, we pray that Nine Marks Audio will benefit both you and your local church. Listen, learn, and join the conversation.
This is Mark Dever. It is August 24, 2009. We are at St. Andrew's Cathedral in Sydney, Australia, and I'm here with my friend Matt Chandler.
Yes, it's good to be here, Mark.
Matt, stop looking for the cameras. There are no cameras.
I know, it feels a little bit like that, doesn't it?
It's just an audio interview,
thank you.
All right?
Thank you. Well, you know, I'm 35. Most of what we do now is video because there's this thing called the internet and you can stream it. And
I've heard of this.
See, so that's I'm more used to just video stuff, but it's okay.
You know, Minneapolis, Dallas, Louisville, you know, all these places we've met up this year.
Sure.
And I think, was it you that said, hey, let's meet at the coast? And then I think, okay, Sydney. That's what I said.
That's it. But, and you left out Dallas because we had a good stake in Dallas.
And Dallas. And now here we are in Sydney, Australia.
It's a nice place.
Now, other than being all over YouTube, what do you do?
Well, for the record, we've never put anything on YouTube. You can thank our friends at Desiring God for all of that.
Okay. No. I think I saw a non-Desiring God things with Matt Chandler on YouTube.
Sure, but it wasn't put out by the Village Church or
okay.
by Matt Chandler.
Okay.
Somebody has cut that from something and put it out. So
okay.
we're I don't think we score that high on the entrepreneurial tests yet to do that kind of thing.
Okay, so well, speaking of entrepreneurial, what are you doing in Australia?
I was invited to do Engage 09 and then a couple of pastors' conferences and a church planning conference and just to come down and preach and teach. And I don't think I'm doing any lecturing, but just come to do some teaching.
And how's the trip been?
You know, it's very early on for me. I've only been here a few days, but so far it's been tremendous. Particularly, I spoke at a thing called RICE, which was about 4,000. They say it's not just Asians.
Mm-hmm.
It's 4,000 Asians. There were 3 white people there. I was one of them.
Okay.
So, and then Chavez, who's Hispanic. So it's very much 4,000 Asian students. Got to preach the gospel to them. It was tremendous. Like, I don't know how else to explain it. It was very youth. I mean, it reminded me a lot of youth ministry in the States. And mm-hmm. it was just kind of crazy and loud. And a lot of it I didn't really know what to make of. But they let me preach. And man, there was just a powerful response to the gospel message. That I didn't try to, you know, prime it or anything. You just preach the gospel and say, if you want to respond to this, you know, here's how you might respond to this.
Do you do much evangelistic preaching?
I'm hoping that I'm always doing evangelistic preaching, right? But not like that. Not where they've said the bulk of this crowd are not believers.
Right.
And so that is a rare opportunity for me, for someone to set up an event that is primarily, these are people who are not saved, preach the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in, I was in heaven.
Your ministry is sort of aimed in large part, at nominal Christians.
It's
certainly Christians, building up Christians. I want to be clear about that.
It's
nominal Christians.
Absolutely. And I think that's because of my location, to be honest with you. I think that...
Dallas, Texas.
Yeah, because I've never felt that was my ministry. In fact, my natural inclination is one of an evangelist. And so I've always been drawn to people who don't know the gospel. Like, I want to share it with them. I want to talk. So it was really kind of a revelation to me. That this is what God was doing with my life, is He was putting me in what Christianity Today in 1998 called the center of the evangelical world to do ministry. And so this has kind of been me kind of waking up to that, and then other people noticing that what we're doing is a little bit different than what's going on in Dallas and wanting me to talk. You know, everybody who's called and asked me to speak, even Piper and Driscoll, those guys want me to talk about how you reach religious people.
Hmm.
So it just kind of clicked for me last year. This is how people see me.
Yeah.
I had never thought of it that way. I'm trying to win the lost.
So do you ever end up speaking to agnostics?
If I am, it's because of something that I've set up within the confines of Dallas.
Okay.
But people don't, because I'm a former agnostic myself. I always just kind of had a real high awareness of spiritual things from as far back as I can remember. And so anyone who is somewhat spiritual but doesn't quite understand Christianity, to me, that is, I want time there.
Mm.
And so, you know, I've set up things in my own neighborhood. I've set up things in and around Dallas. I almost always intro the welcome at the Village is always, if you're a first-time guest with us, I'm guessing you're here along one of two lanes. Either you've got a background in church and you've come here either to check us out because a friend invited you or whatever. That's lane one. If you need information, here's where you find it. Lane two is that you've got no background in church or you haven't been in church in forever. And you, you know, as a former agnostic myself, although I'd love to answer any questions you have. So I'm kind of fishing for them to
shoot me
emails. Oh, absolutely. All the time. In fact, in the last time we did baptisms, four or five of the testimonies said in the water that it was that invitation that made them go, I'm coming back next week.
Praise God.
And so that to me has been
so good. Note to pastors listening, speak to non-Christians.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, every week if you came to the Village in the welcome, you're going to hear me say.
Now, honestly, Matt, there are going to be a lot of non-Christians or agnostics who are going to end up going to the Village more than most of our churches, me or others who are listening to this, because you're either popular or experiencing a revival. I mean, when you talked about being at this youth meeting two nights ago, how do you distinguish between popularity and revival?
Well,
when you're a gospel preacher like yourself.
Well, I'll be real honest. I think time's going to tell that.
Yeah.
I don't know how to tell that. Where I am, I know what I listen for is not great job, Matt, but you have no idea the impact that's had on my understanding of who God is and how I live my life. And so that's what I have to listen for. And where I hear that quite a bit, I start to grow in confidence and gratitude for what God's doing. But where I hear, you've got to come here, Matt, it wears me down. And you and I have talked about this some. I'm almost constantly nervous about what's happened over the last couple of years where people go, oh, that's Matt Chandler, or get Matt Chandler, or there's a real anxiety in me. And I've had to have some real good godly men go, you need to quit apologizing for that and let the Lord do what the Lord wants to do. Mm-hmm. And so, time is going to tell whether or not this is a personality-driven ministry or this is revival.
My guess is your wife, Lauren, helps.
Yes. Yeah, she really does. There's no, oh, that's Matt Chandler coming out of the house. I can tell you that right now. She's a beautiful woman who's not all that impressed, to be honest with you. So, but she, you know, Lauren is, I mean, she's spectacular. She's independent enough to let me do what God's asked me to do, but she still wants me around when I'm there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been a real gift to me.
I've had the joy to meet her just a few times at the conference in Dallas, and the Lord seems to have equipped you very well with a wonderful wife.
Yeah, she loves the Lord, loves the gospel. I mean, I have a 3-month-old daughter, and we knew this trip was going to come up when we had an infant.
Yeah.
And
Reed
is my boy. He's
that's right.
Three.
Okay,
Audrey
I met Reed, and Audrey was born. That's right.
And then Audrey's six, actually. She's
okay.
My oldest.
Okay.
And then Nora
there we go.
Is the new baby. And we prayed about it. I showed her, hey, this is an opportunity. You need to pray. You need to sign off on this. We'll have an infant. And she was, you've got to go do this. So she's just very supportive of it.
Now, did you grow up in a Christian home?
No, I wouldn't call it that. My mom might disagree with me on that, but my mom was a preacher's kid. Her dad was somewhat of a fundamentalist, backwoods, Missouri, in the sticks, legalist. I don't know, do all those adjectives work? So I think my mom had a real good grasp on morality, but not a real good grasp on the gospel. But her one great rebellion was marrying my father. Well, just very abusive background, so very violent man, very addicted man.
Not a believer.
Nowhere near a believer,
okay.
Although I think he could give lip service to it at times.
Yeah.
But my father was not converted until well into my conversion.
Hmm.
And so, not a Christian home at all. Kind of a dark place most of the time.
And you talk about that sometimes.
Sure. Yeah, I talk about it quite a bit because God's grace in that. You know, both my parents they have a real powerful relationship with the Lord right now. Mm-hmm. And both of them are actively involved in ministries. My father ministers in, I want to be careful with this language because I think people mishear it, our recovery program, which in the end is just biblical discipleship on steroids.
Right.
It's not let's heal the inner child. It's here's where the Bible says you're idolatrous and need to repent.
Yeah. Ed Welch has a good book on addictions.
Absolutely.
And Crossroads, I think is what they call the...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we... So he's highly involved in that, ministers to men with his background. He just a tremendous man right now. Still healing, still growing, still... but a tremendous man. But growing up, he was just kind of antagonistic against the gospel. And
so how did you become a Christian?
You know, we moved to Texas. My dad was in the military, so we kind of moved around. And a guy on the football team named Jeff Faircloth actually just started sharing the gospel with me. And so up until then, I was immensely confused on what Christianity was, because my mom, in the end, was somewhat of a moral deist. I mean, she was, there is a God, so you better behave. So, but it didn't make any sense to me. In fact, I remember, I joke about this sometimes with her, because I can remember going to Vacation Bible School and they sang a song. They were quoting, I believe they were quoting Romans, but anyway, it was just basically we were singing that God hated liars. And I can remember thinking, okay, then I'm in a lot of trouble here, because I'm a liar. I'm actually singing a song about how God hates me at Vacation Bible School. And so for me, I was just always very confused on what it was. I'm growing up as a teenager in the late 80s, early 90s. So youth ministry back then was True Love Waits driven. It was We Don't Drink Alcohol driven. It was all what Christian Smith would call Christian therapeutic moralistic deism, right? Mm-hmm. It was we don't hang out with these people. We don't go here. And so I was just confused. If they were preaching the gospel, they were not preaching it in a way that I could hear or understand. So to have God send me Jeff Faircloth, who could answer my questions, who could wade me through what was a real weird, brittle evangelicalism, to explain to me what was going on with Michael W. Smith and DC Talk, to explain to me what's going on in, you know, I remember watching the video, I think Focus on the Family put it out, called Hell's Bells, that said if we listened to Journey, we were going to end up doing meth and maybe kill our parents, right? And so...
That was doing meth, not doing math.
Yeah, yeah, no, yes. Don't, yeah. Yes. Yeah, the Baptists had nothing, no problem with math.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's having to wade me through that. He's having to go, okay, let me... To be honest, sometimes he was having to go, let me explain who Journey is. You know, we weren't listening to Journey by the time that video hit the store. So he kind of walked me through that. And it was actually after he left, I went back to youth camp on my own, which to me was, youth camp to me, my junior and senior year of high school, felt like a Saturday Night Live sketch. Mm. And part of that was I didn't understand why everybody's going down front. I don't understand why everybody's crying. I don't understand why every night at the end of the sermon we've got to literally sing until everyone gets saved again. And so, just wildly confusing. And I have no idea who preached my senior year, but I do remember what he said. And what he preached was, he actually walked through the life of Jesus, and he was showing where Jesus knows the future, where Jesus sees the future, where Jesus is telling them what's coming. And then he goes to Hebrews 12, whom for the joy set before him endured the cross. And then he goes... Okay, let's go read the crucifixion. Let's find the joy in it, right? And so he starts unpacking the crucifixion, and he's going, okay, where's the joy in that? Well, the joy in that is the purchasing of many sons. And then he began to just talk about, if Christ is aware of all your failings, all your shortcomings, and all your sins, and still goes to the cross, is it so hard to believe that this could be for you? Hmm. And so we know it. We know what's happening now, theologically, right? My eyes are open, and I'm going, okay, I'm in. And I've just really never recovered from that
night.
And
why did you get in at that point? I mean, I understand theologically, but what's going on inside that?
Well, you know, for me, and like I said, it's still somewhat of a mystery for me. I had started to really kind of appreciate the Christians that I knew. I started to really appreciate Jeff and then some of the guys he had introduced me with. I still thought a lot of their worldview was really silly. You know, they were arguing about whether or not it was sinful or not for them to go see Terminator 2. Right? I could go, okay, that's silly. But they just had this the only way I know to explain it is they just had this deep awareness of God that I was kind of jealous of.
That's what Bunyan says in his Grace Abounding. It's when you hear those washerwomen speak,
sure,
speaking as if they knew
that,
God.
Like, yeah, and that was exactly what it was for me, where they would come. They would get... they would get so excited about these Bible texts that they found. So they're growing up in church, but they're still, I guess, I'm thinking back on it, I'm going, I wonder where they were in their journey,
mm-hmm.
right? But they would get so excited about, like, I'll give you this little bit. Philippians 1:21, they would sign all the little notes they wrote to each other, ready to die. Philippians 1:21. So I was jealous of that. Like, I was going, this is, I like this. So that was really a draw for me. And then, I don't know, at that moment, it just kind of, like, I was one of them then, you know. I just very quickly became one of them. And then very quickly became a leader in that group.
And how old were you when you became a pastor? 17, 18?
Are we talking about the first time I've worked at a church as a minister?
No, I'm talking about the pastor of a church.
My first official, I am the lead pastor.
Yes.
I was 28.
Okay, and that's the village, just the church right now.
Yeah, it's the only church I've ever been the senior pastor of.
Yeah. How did you become a pastor?
Are you asking how I became pastor of the village or how I got into ministry?
Well, we don't take much time on the ministry because I think you had a sort of unique speaking ministry, which is interesting.
Absolutely.
So give us 60 seconds on that. But no, then I'm asking, how did you get into a local church as the pastor?
Okay, how I got into the ministry is I didn't want to go off to college. I didn't feel some overt call to the ministry at all. In fact, I wouldn't even quite understood that. And then, you know, to me at that time, pastors looked real weird in jeans, and I just wasn't interested, you know. But I did love the Bible very much, and I had a couple opportunities to talk with people about the Bible, and so I think I had natural abilities in that arena very early on that some guys saw. But I ended up not going to college. I went to a JUCO around home because I didn't want to leave the Christian base I had found. I didn't feel comfortable just being out on my own yet. And so I took a job at Pine Drive Christian School as a janitor and went to a JUCO and a junior college. And then through the most random of circumstances, I ended up teaching at the chapel there. And a pastor was in the back who then said, hey, come be the youth minister at our church. And boom, there we go. And so when you're cleaning toilets and changing ballasts and someone goes, how about we pay you the same to preach the Bible? I mean, that was a no-brainer to me. But at this time, I'm still not thinking I'm called to the ministry. At this time, I'm thinking...
What?
I'm thinking, how cool is it that I make money for preaching the Bible?
But, I mean, are you thinking you're going to do that long-term?
No,
I'm thinking about long-term.
Because somewhat that turned into a nightmare for me. Because, keep in mind, I have no background in church. I understand nothing about tradition. I understand nothing about the roots of Sunday school, vacation Bible school. I know nothing of... So all I can see is, when I walk into that, is you guys are about 30 years behind where you need to be in regards to engaging, I mean, my own generation. I mean, I'm 18, 19 years old.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I don't want to go to associational camp and watch a man do a chalk talk and then turn on a black light and see a cross behind the picture of a monster that he drew. So I wanted to do things like Super Summer. And I just wasn't very politically savvy. And so it went pretty bad pretty quick. And so I very quickly went...
What do you mean it went pretty bad pretty quick?
I think I insulted a lot of people. I failed to honor the good, right, godly things that had been used in the past to win people. And I just wanted reform without honoring who was there, what it meant to them, and without really the ability to. So, I mean, you can just imagine. I'm young, I'm arrogant, I don't think anything is working like it should. And so I'm also, I mean, I'm very vocal and very opinionated. And so those things, before God began to sanctify them, got me into quite a bit of trouble. And so that's what happened.
So what are you doing by the time you're 25?
By the time I'm 25, I'm in Abilene, Texas. I've finished my degree. I'm working at Beltway Park Baptist Church as kind of a utility back. So I'm just doing whatever they want me to do, preaching.
Matt Schmucker's here. Matt, a utility back. Can you help
me
with that? I mean,
do you not know what that means? So I can play wide receiver or tailback or
either
whatever.
One. Yeah,
right,
sure. That's good.
Either one.
All right, keep going.
So I'm teaching a Bible study on Thursday night called Grace Bible Study, which was kind of an ecumenical gathering.
So by that point, had you finished college?
Yes.
And your job full-time was with the church?
I spent probably 70% of my time at the church and 30% of my time traveling and speaking, and that was kind of the deal we had worked out that way.
And by the time you're 28, though, that changes and you become the pastor of a local church yourself.
Yes, I'd started a nonprofit organization with some friends of mine, moved to Dallas, was operating out of Dallas.
Operating?
Basing.
facing.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Okay, so I'm basically doing itinerant ministry.
Okay.
I'm traveling and speaking and teaching.
Okay.
And so we moved.
So what you're doing this week, you were doing every week?
Yes. Yes.
Absolutely. This week being this right now in Australia. This is the kind of thing that you were doing.
I'm teaching at Prestonwood every Monday night to a couple thousand 20-somethings.
Okay.
And then teaching Tuesday night still in Abilene. And then coming home to Dallas on Wednesday and Thursday, and then flying out usually Friday morning to speak at a church or do a revival or, right? Wow. Because by this time, I'm not, I think, in regards to church work, I need to be outside of her, not inside of her. I need to.
So then what happens a few years later in, what, 2002?
Yeah.
What happens in 2002 to flip you over to be the pastor of a local church?
Well, a couple of things. Beltway was a real healing experience for me. David McQueen, who was the pastor there, really invited me into understanding how churches work and what, you know, he let me sit in elders' meeting. I wasn't allowed to really talk unless I was spoken to, but I was allowed to sit in and listen. I was allowed to speak into certain things. He would ask me, like, there's so many times in the middle of an elders' meeting, he would go, Matt, what do you think? And then he would let me say what I think. And so there was a real healing process for me. And he also, it was the first time I'd seen church done outside of a simple Sunday school education model and traditional service model. So it was an interesting church that I really healed a lot in. And so I moved to Dallas where I'm still not sure that I'm called to be a pastor of any kind. I'm definitely know I'm a teacher. And a woman who sat on our board.
Wait, you're saying that about in 2002 or 2009?
This is 2002.
2002, you didn't know if you were called.
Oh, absolutely. Now I absolutely know, right?
Good.
So, yeah, this interview would take a hard left then, I guess, if I said that.
Well, it would be a different conversation.
Sure. A woman who sat on our board of directors for the nonprofit I was running went to Highland Village First Baptist Church. It was a church that had fallen on some real hard times. They had tried to follow the Willow model. It had gone bad. And so my sister and her husband were going to this church. I'd actually had multiple conversations with my sister about why she was there. In my view of things, and there's some of the old guys that are still at the Village who would disagree with me here, but I went a couple of times because my sister was singing the special. No one's got a Bible. They're showing the Bible on the screen. The message is unbelievably practical and almost void of any bit of nature and character of God. And so I used to just plead with my little sister. I'm like, you've got to get out of here. This makes no sense to me why you would be here. Not only that, but they were by far the youngest people there. And so the lady who was on our board of directors went to that church also. And they were without a pastor, had been out without a pastor for a couple of years. They had gone through 200 and something resumes. She calls me and says, will you turn in a resume? So I felt like I was in a little bit of a quandary. She was a board member. She had given a lot of money into our nonprofit. And so I felt like in order to honor her, I would turn in the resume, but I don't want the job. And so I thought that my plan was to just kill it. They are a Willow Creek First Baptist Church. I am complementarian in my view of the gender roles. I am Calvinistic in my soteriology. I believe in elder government in my ecclesia. So, I mean, you just go down the line, you go, I'll kill this thing so fast. We'll have one meeting and we'll be done. And so I began to meet. There were a couple of things that were colliding. I began to meet with them. They would ask questions. I would answer them, and I would think it was a done deal. Like, I literally, on two occasions, got in my car, called my wife, and said, okay, it's over. Only to have them call me back the next day and go, can you come teach us why you land there? And so then I would go back. Now, in hindsight, I think what was happening was they were coming to Metro on Monday night. See, they had been taught in that Willow model that if you're strong theologically, that people aren't going to come. And they're not going to listen, and they're not going to get saved, and they're not going to.
Isn't that terrible?
It really is, but that's what they were taught. Yeah. I mean, I had a guy tell me that worship is the enemy of evangelism.
Oh,
then I got to say that to me. I was like, that is the dumbest thing I've heard in my life. Now, granted, I was only 28. I've heard dumber since then. But that, at the time, that I was like, that's madness. Like, what you're saying is crazy talk. But then here I was getting up in front of 2,000, 3,000, 20-somethings and going line by line through Romans 8 And so I think it blew up their framework. So now they're trying to relearn. And so they were going, okay, come tell us why you land there. Come tell us why you land there. Come tell us why you land there. So it was this several month process of me thinking it's over and then having to go back. And so then they offered me, come preach in Buell McCall, which is get your one good sermon and we'll vote yes, right? And so I said, well, how about we do that? How about we do a Q&A first with me and the whole congregation? Because my plan at that point was, if I can't kill it with the search team, I can most definitely kill it with the people. So we go do this Q&A. I just remember Lauren and I went and bought me some slacks at Banana Republic, right? And
what were you wearing before then?
Jeans.
Oh, right.
I wear now,
good.
Right?
All right.
Yeah. And so I go get some slacks and I go and do this Q&A. The first question was from a man named Ron Cuny. He raises his hand and he says, everybody buys a house knowing that there's something about that house they're going to change the second they move in. What's that here? And so I was just, in my head I'm going, jackpot. I don't even have to answer any more questions of this. And so just kind of, because there was some real silliness going on. There are a church of 100 people trying to do the Willow model. So, and this is no exaggeration, there's 6 people on microphones on the worship team. There's as many people on the stage as there is in the crowd. And so I'm going, well, worship style is really showy and really strange to me. System of government was a, I have no idea where they got this model. You probably do. But it was, if you led any ministry in the church, you were a part of the deciding council.
Of the church council. Yeah.
So basically the guy mowing the lawn on Saturday is an elder. And so I talked a little bit about system of government. I just kind of was really honest. And man, they still wanted me to come and preach in view. And so that's when Lauren and I were going, okay, what do we want to do here? Because I definitely just didn't see my life playing out as a pastor of a church in the suburbs of Dallas. I think we're going, okay, let's give this a couple years and see what happens.
Who do you tell this story to?
Everyone.
You tell the story once a month?
Two. Probably early on I told it a lot more. Because people would ask me about it. I think it's out on the internet quite a bit, and so people don't ask me as much about it anymore. Now, we're probably in a different circle here than
what do you mean by that? Never mind. That's fine.
No, it's not a bad thing. It's just that young 20-somethings know our story, know who I am.
Right.
If you get... Here's a brilliant example. I'm out in Raleigh, North Carolina, doing the Advance conference. So Piper's there, Driscoll's there, I'm there. Well, the guys who put on that conference set up a dinner with John Piper, me, and about 13, 14 other guys. All right. So I'm in the meeting. I'm going to listen to John. I don't even know that it hadn't clicked for me that they've also come to hear what I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
And it became very apparent very quickly that half of that room had no idea who I was and knew exactly who John Piper was. And the other half of the room had no idea who John Piper was but knew exactly who I was.
Wow.
And so there's a little bit of a schism, right? There's a little bit of a gap in who knows what and who. And so you mention this guy's name in this circle and nobody knows who he is.
Yeah.
You mention him and he's the most famous guy in the world, right?
Yeah.
And so that's all I meant by that.
All right, so when you go to the church, you've been there 6 or 7 years now. What's happened to the church since then?
Well, we spent a lot of time the first year or two resetting doctrinally what the church believed. And so...
No, you're not saying they had the gospel wrong.
No, I might be saying that.
Okay.
I could say this. There was no understanding of atonement whatsoever.
Wow.
There was a Jesus loves you, say this prayer, and things will get better. It was kind of that idea. Which I guess is is that very popular evangelical?
Yeah.
You know, Jesus loves you, say this prayer and you're in.
Yeah.
You know, do you want to go to hell? No, you don't. Okay, you need to say this prayer. Or very kind of pragmatic, 8 ways to be a good man type stuff. And so I preached the first really year and a half, I preached the book of Ephesians. To me, that Ephesians is just such a beautiful book when it comes to the church.
Mm.
You know, the first early part, here's what's going on. Okay, here's what it looks like after this is what God's doing. And so taught through that. And so the first really year and a half was just kind of reorienting how we saw the Bible. And, you know, you need to bring your Bible and point your finger to it often. You're going to say back to me a word in there. So anybody who's listened to me will hear me say, what's that word? What's that word? And really, I'm still doing that. I probably don't need to do that anymore. But that was a very purposeful,
yeah.
You need to bring your Bible because I'm going to ask you to look at it. Mm-hmm. We never, never show texts on a screen. We'll show an address, but we never show a text. We'll show an address and a page number, so if there are lost people there, they can pick up one of our hardback and they can turn to the page.
Hmm.
So it's just really, it was reorienting. We began to grow by droves immediately. Part of that was, you know, I'm 25 minutes from there, I'm teaching to 3,000 people, 68% of whom had no church home. So wow. When I leave that Bible study and I come over to the village, well, I was what they knew. In the end, I was their pastor.
Mm-hmm.
I was who they were receiving teaching from. Mm-hmm. So they just, I mean, we grew by 600 the first 4 months,
wow.
Which all of a sudden gave me an unreal amount of political capital to make changes quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So I think my big fear in my story and in the story of what God's done at the village is that other young guys hear what happened and how we changed things. And so they go into their church and they start trying to force things and push things. We're going to get into elders by year two. We're going to get it. But really what changed the tide at the village was an explosion of numeric growth.
Yeah.
That gave me the political capital to go, oh, no, it is working. So I didn't have to say, which is what most pastors say, if we make these changes, we'll be healthier and things will happen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, things were happening, and I got to say, because things are happening, we better get straight.
Yeah.
And that's a little bit different. I think that's it doesn't translate to other people.
So when you went there, how many people were coming?
My first Sunday, there were 168 people, and I apologize, divided into two services.
And then now, leading off, how many services you're having? How many people come?
Right now, we run between 6,000 and 7,000 on the weekends. So it's pretty crazy.
Why do you think young people like your teaching so much?
I think I'm very aggressive with them, and I'm not afraid to say very hard things to them. Like it at least once a month, I tell the bulk of our crowd that I don't believe they're saved, and here's why I don't think you're saved. And so for whatever reason, that has caused this real. You've got to come listen to this, because I think every.
There's a kind of look at that car wreck. I mean, you're not saying that it's not a.
No, but here's what I think: the bulk of Dallas evangelicalism is let me help you feel better about you and where you are.
Uh-huh.
Let me give you the confidence to walk proudly in your. I'm actually coming from the other angle and go. Part of the reason you might be struggling the way you are is because you're actually not a believer. And so I think it's just a different voice where I think a lot of people are trying to hold on to their crowd. I'm trying to create space as best I can. I'm trying to find the elect as best I can. And so I think that there's something. Okay, I'll just use. I think there's something fresh about that to 20 somethings because I think they're starting to spot some of the kitschy ways we're trying to get them into church. And so for me to go, I don't care if you stay here or not.
And being a pastor, do you think sometimes people hear you and they try to follow your model in a way you don't mean them to follow it?
Well, I think it happens all the time. And I think it's really a product of where we are in really with technology and with the availability to listen.
Because people hear things like this or they hear your sermons.
Well, absolutely. Well, the podcast is, you know, people will listen to... say me or Mark Driscoll or John Piper and then without any regard to their own context, a perfect example would be a guy in the backwoods of Alabama trying to plant Mars Hill.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just not very smart. And so in the end, I think I've got a great concern that people will go, oh, that's what you have to do. You just have to tell everybody they're lost all the time. And so God's given me a favor in that I can stand up and say that. And for some reason, people really begin to look at their hearts and look at where they are and weigh out the text on their lives and respond. And so, I don't know, I do worry about that quite a bit. I worry about that for the Acts 29 network because of the guys that we put on the stage quite a bit. And we've all got these stories of, we tend to be aggressive, we tend to be a little brash, and then my fear is that we create a bunch of guys that weren't designed that way, weren't called to be that way, to act that way.
Yeah.
So it's absolutely a concern.
You know, this is something we touched on a little bit earlier, but you do have fans.
No doubt.
Is it a trial being an apparently successful pastor?
Well, you know, for me, people are going to do what they're going to do. I'm not going to feed it. So you're not going to get to... So with certain things, and I get talked to quite a bit from my own generation about this. So Facebook, I did start after Al kind of pulled me aside and chatted with me a little bit. I did start to use Twitter a little bit. And I'll just, man, I mean, one of the things I do with Twitter is I just go back over my old manuscripts. I cut out a sentence and then put it in and then, you know, tweet it. But I just don't want to feed it. And so I don't want to do anything that goes, let's talk about me or let's, you know, so I just try to avoid that as best I can. I want to be unassuming and low maintenance and unentitled, and you know, I want to kind of do it that way.
Yeah, people can't see the entourage you're traveling with here in Australia.
Sure.
This is amazing.
Sure. Yeah, they're massive.
Yeah,
right?
No, he doesn't need any more lemonade right now. Thanks. Tom, no.
It's the wrong temperature.
Oh,
the wrong
my
temperature.
Goodness.
Sure.
Let's turn to some ministry stuff.
Okay.
Huge church you have now. What are you guys doing to train pastors and elders in your church?
Sure. We do quite a bit. And so...
So let's say I'm a 22-year-old guy who's just finished college. I've been coming to your church, and you think, you've heard that I lead small groups okay, and that I'd like to preach. What do you do with me? What do you tell me to do?
A couple of things. We have a couple of different lanes, to be honest with you, depending on where you are in your own spiritual maturity, depending where you are in your strengths,
yeah.
Depending on how much of the Bible you know, what kind of grasp of theology you have. Because we're really blessed in Dallas. You've got several large seminaries
yeah.
right there around us.
Yeah.
And so we have a tendency to have a great deal of guys who are in those seminaries that actually come to the village. And so several opportunities. We do Saturday seminars where we'll have... I rarely, if ever, teach a Saturday seminar at the Village Church. That's either laymen or other pastors of ours. So they'll teach anything from... how to study the Bible, 101. How to study the Bible, 201. A big one we did last year was, is the Village Church emergent? Because everybody thinks because I'm in my 30s and I wear jeans that we're emergent. I'll say anyone over a certain age thinks that.
Okay.
So I get characterized as that quite a bit.
Okay.
So we did that just to put it online so people understand. Let's define what these words mean to begin with. That would really be helpful. We've done racial reconciliation. So we have those Saturday seminars. We do Friday night culture and theology. I've never taught a Friday night culture and theology. We have pastoral training that I do teach at the Village. So, and
what's that kind of stuff?
It could be anything from missiology. So how are we looking at Dallas, Texas? How do we engage Dallas, Texas? How do we plant churches in Dallas, Texas? How do we... To the one I'm doing in September with our pastoral staff, and we'll invite some other pastoral staffs, is shepherding to truth, which is this idea of truth isn't just something we possess, but something that we've been charged to shepherd people to. So what does it look like not to go, this is the truth, you need it, but to actually shepherd people towards that, to walk people towards that? How do we confront erroneous theology in a way that is biblically faithful? So how are we able to take a guy and go, okay, instead of going, this is what the Bible says, if you don't like it, get out. How can we actually shepherd people towards truth so that the win is maybe after a little bit more of a lengthy process, they arrive at what is true versus isolating? And it's been my experience that early on we did a great deal of that. Now that we're at 7,000, if you don't like it, leave, which is a real horrible spirit.
Yeah.
It's a real horrible attitude. But early on, we were, oh, you land there? Okay, well, let's do this. Let's sit down for a couple. Hey, let me show you a couple. Go read these texts. In the full, read the chapters before, chapters after, and then let's come back and talk about it. Now it's more, this is where we land. If you don't like it, there's a lot of other churches around here you can go to. So I just started noticing that around our pastors. So I went, okay, here's what we're teaching in September. And so something like that would be what I teach.
So what do you do about Hebrew and Greek?
Okay, Redeemer Seminary, which used to be Westminster Dallas, they've offered to do Greek classes for us. We have a slew of students that or a slew of young men that will go and get their Greek and Hebrew down there. Elliot Green down there. I'm not sure if you know Elliot, who's brilliant. He's come in and worked with, I know several of our Bo Hughes. We had just a big group of pastors that actually went and sat down with him, so he's been walking them through some things. We've had John Hanna, who's at Dallas Theological Seminary, brilliant church historian, specifically the John Owen and some of those guys. He's come in and taught mortification, vivification. Mm. So we've really tried to leverage the seminaries and guys. Daryl Box come in and done some things for us. We've just kind of tried to utilize the guys that are around us.
Now, if you're in a place like Dallas, Texas, which you are, and given the history of your own congregation, What do you advise young guys about sort of church planting versus church recovery?
Yeah, you know, statistically, church recovery is a pretty bloody game.
Oh, I'm well aware.
I mean, it's a pretty bloody game. And so I think there has to be a real clear, I've been called to this. And that's equally true of planting. But in church recovery, we just had a lot of failures in church recovery, far more than planting.
Yeah.
And so
I think the casualties are always higher on those beaches.
Yeah, there's no doubt. So yeah. You know, I've had to really do a. I've spent a great deal of time with guys in Dallas who are trying to do that,
mm-hmm.
and trying to coach them. Unfortunately, at times, out of theory and not my own experience. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
So I talk a great deal about honoring what's old while you're pressing on to what's new, you know, those mm-hmm. kind of things. But in reality, I didn't have to do a whole bunch of that because the older people at the village, even the 60 and 70-year-olds, were seeing 20-somethings come in.
Yeah,
and so
they were
your
biggest fans.
Oh, I don't care. Change the music. God, I don't care. If this is what we get to do, like Del Steele, he's going, you're telling me I get 6 20-year-old boys coming into my house to read the Bible, study the Bible, and learn about life? If you'll preach the Bible and this will keep happening, you kill VBS tomorrow. And so, you know, I didn't have to do a lot of the political games that some of these guys have to do.
Okay, so in your setting in Dallas, what are some challenges that Christians face? Earlier this morning, you and I had breakfast with Philip Jensen.
Sure.
Philip was laying out some of the challenges he thinks Christians face in Sydney. You talk about Dallas for a minute. What are the challenges that Christians are facing there?
Well, I think Dallas evangelicalism and biblical Christianity are not the same thing. And so you have a lot of people that grew up in church who have no intention of following Jesus Christ on a daily basis, have no intention of submitting their lives to Him as Lord, but have been taught and who understand that I prayed a prayer at youth camp when I was 12 after somebody got up and said, "Do you want to burn in hell forever? Do you want to go to heaven with mommy and daddy?" And they did some sort of terrifying skit where they drug somebody off stage screaming and then gave a 50-minute invitation that I was moved to come down and respond to, that I'm a believer. And so by far, for me, the challenge is there's an assumed gospel in most churches, which means most churches aren't preaching the gospel. They're assuming it. It's that they think everybody understands it, everybody knows it, so it's not ever really clearly articulated. And so people have a tendency to do a comparison, moral comparison of, I watch the news, I'm not killing people, I'm not raping people, I'm not stealing things, I'm a good man, I prayed the prayer when I was 12 at youth camp, I'm saved.
Hmm.
And so this is very much our climate. And so that's what the challenge is. People think they're saved, they think they're believers, there's literally no fruit of that, no understanding of what the Bible actually teaches.
In the broader culture, though, the Christian, the people who are regenerate, they're facing, what, heavy materialism?
I mean, it's Dallas, bro. There's nothing else there but shopping. I mean, you've been there. There's no mountain. Okay. There's no ocean. There's no port. All the lakes are man-made. It's a city that should not exist. It is a city that is there by will. And so, yeah, it's absolutely materialistic, consumeristic, very, like they
confident.
Even have phrases.
People are self-confident.
Unbelievably self-confident, self-made.
Does it lead to a kind of subjectivism? That is, I'm not going to read the Bible, I'm more going to do what I feel the Lord wants me to do. I think God
Yeah,
wants
I think
me
that's
do.
Somewhat everywhere right now, though, isn't
no.
it? I would say that's probably everywhere. Maybe, I haven't sensed that there's more of that in Dallas than I've seen in other places. There is I think the rugged individualism that Americans are famous for is very strong in Dallas.
Yeah.
So what's difficult is to get people to... So one of the things I say all the time is that although your faith is very personal, it isn't private. And so that's a very strange idea to them, you know, that you do life with one another in real, deep, authentic community, because we have so many shows down there.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost the Vegas of evangelicalism. You know, you just have a lot of fogs and lasers and tigers on stage. So,
well, do you think members of the Village Church are consumers?
No, absolutely. Absolutely they are. Now, I'll be very aggressive with them about that. But I think one of the great frustrations is the more aggressive I am, the more it becomes just a different kind of show.
Yeah.
So I don't know what to do except preach the truth and preach the gospel and let God in the end deal with those kind of, you know, I talk all the time about the ecclesiological buffet and, you know, if you're, I kind of think of it in three circles. If you believe and you're kind of going here, but you don't support, you're a rebel. If you you believe but you don't belong, you believe and you support but you don't belong, then you're just a consumer. You're not living out what this mm-hmm. thing is. You know, so I try to teach those things often. Membership is held in extremely high regard, from the membership process to what our covenant is to what we require, and so we just kind of teach that and push that. And
I had a wonderful time with your elders.
Yeah, they were. They're good men.
You got a great group.
They're good men.
Have you done much training of them? Or?
We did before any of them were elders. Because keep in mind, this is kind of our initial wave, right?
Yeah, yeah.
We did a year solid of training, both theological as well as in regards to leadership, how we stylistically wanted to do this, how we wanted their interaction. Because we didn't want... I have great friends who I respect and admire a great deal who have elders at their church, and no one in the church really knows who the elders are.
Hmm.
So they're kind of this, they meet on once a month in a dark room where they're the only ones that have the code to it. But we wanted our guys to be very visible, very well known, and very approachable. So we talked about how to do that in a church our size.
Hmm.
So.
Are there any theological challenges you guys are facing as a congregation these days? What kind of theological ones are bold?
I don't know if it's a challenge, but it's an ongoing conversation. We are, in regards to exegesis, continualist.
Mm-hmm.
Not. We believe that the gifts of the Spirit, we're not cessationist.
Right.
Okay? So, textually, that's where we land. In regards to practice... there is no practice.
Yeah.
I don't know that there needs to be, or there should be, but it's almost this constant, what do we do with this? If we understand the Bible to teach this, and we wouldn't agree with those who would teach cessationism, we wouldn't believe that they are exegetically correct. What does that mean? And so there's that tension, because I've got, once again, men I admire very much who goes, that means this.
Yeah.
That means this.
Don Carson's book, Showing the Spirit, has been so helpful.
Beautiful.
Wonderful treatment. 1 Corinthians 12:14. The point of every gift God's Spirit gives is to build up the church.
Absolutely.
And so there's no list that's meant to be replicated in any particular church. He does whatever he wants to do.
So what do you do with... I mean, so the conversations will come up when someone at our church who is a member says... I really feel like the Lord's given me the gift of prophecy. So then we have to go, okay, define that for us. What do you mean by that?
Yeah.
How does that... So then that's when we get into it. Because there are guys, you know, I've got two guys that were actually educated at DTS that, I mean, just immediately go... I mean, they just clench up at mm-hmm. even the discussion of that. I mean, they're just like, oh, before you know it, we're going to be Benny, you know, you'll be Benny Hinn, and, you know, mm-hmm. and then you have others that are like, hey, God, we've got to have an understanding of this.
Would you say right now that at the Village that the Word is at the center of all your ministry?
The Word is at the center and will always be at the center of what we do and who we are. And so that what you'll hear in our membership class is everything is fair game around here in regards to change, except the proclamation of the Word, which is always going to be central. And then the other thing we use is just a real open authenticity about where we are in life and where we are with the Lord. And so even in our service, it's very... I mean, you'll find that even the service is built around the Word, that you come to the Village, it's going to be an hour and 15 minutes, 45 to 50 minutes of that is simply the proclamation of the Word.
And would you guys be theologically distinct from the other Southern Baptist churches around you there in Dallas-Fort Worth?
There would be no doubt about that.
In what sense?
Well, we're Calvinistic,
right?
Which is, I mean, there's a branch in the Baptists that are okay with that. There's a branch that is very antagonistic against that idea.
Yeah.
And so I take quite a bit of heat on that one. And so, and then we have an elder form of government, which, you know, I've actually been given a tape series from a well-known Baptist minister on what the Baptist, you know, kind of the things the Baptists better watch out for, and Calvinism and elder government were both on that list. And so, which I'm going, man, that really, that's our two problems.
Yeah.
I've got a different point of view on that, but I think those are the two things that make us a little distinct. But I'm unapologetically Baptist. I'm not, you know, we're not the kind of church that goes, oh, you know, we don't want you to understand. I mean, I love our roots and our history. I definitely have some concerns, but I think it's a beautiful denomination.
Weren't you thankful? I'm certainly thankful in getting to know you this year, really.
Yeah.
That you're both very clear on God's grace and salvation, and very clear in wanting people to come to Christ and being evangelistic. I love that combination.
Well, you know, and what I get to say all the time to guys who be real aggressive for me on our soteriology is that the three churches, really, the two churches in Texas that are very fast growing, very word driven, and are seeing loads and loads and loads of 20-somethings come to know Jesus Christ, are both five-pointers in their soteriology, which is Matt Carter down at Austin Stone, who what they've experienced down there has just been unreal, and then us at the Village Church.
Talking about the love of Jesus, can you tell the Jesus Wants the Rose story? Come on.
Yeah. Come on.
In case there's anybody listening to this, you know, the people who listen to this are John Piper and four other people in their 60s.
We don't
have 20-somethings listening to this.
That's not true, because I actually, well, I didn't know what the thing was when I first got it. I was like, what is this? And someone said, it's a CD.
Oh, cool.
And so I said, so what do you do with it? And they're like,
put it on a record player.
Yeah. So they showed me, we went and found where it goes.
Cool.
And then, so anyway.
But I mean, some people could listen to some MP3. You know, these things.
Sure. Podcasts.
Sure. No, I know.
So,
I'm just giving you a hard time.
So tell us the story, because I heard you share this, and apparently you do it all over the place on the internet.
Maybe
you did it three times.
They're the ones that put it on YouTube.
It's like Tim Keller stuff. You know,
sure.
Tim knows how to take our religiousness and show us that we use it to hide from God.
Yeah.
And it's sort of the turning on the head of Phariseeism. I mean, you do it wonderfully in the story. So, Chandler, Jesus
wrote
the rose.
Sure. Well, to me, it was a turning point. It was a dark point. You know, everybody really likes the story, but it was probably one of the darkest points for me in regards to what my future was going to be with the Christian
Church.
You're
how old then?
I was a freshman in college.
Okay.
But I'd come to Hardin Simmons University. I had to take a fine arts course, and so I picked drama because I didn't know anything about pottery. And, you know, there was only like two or three choices. So I took this drama class, and in it I met a young girl. I say young girl. She was older than me. Already had a child. No church background, no understanding of Christianity. Here she is at this Christian school that's in her area. So she just kind of went to it. She didn't even quite understand that it's a Christian school.
Mm-hmm.
And so we hit up. She's very sarcastic. Very, very sarcastic. Which, you know, my flesh finds
enjoyable.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much so. And so so we just kind of hit it off because, you know, we're in this drama class where they're like, hey, be a tree. So it's very easy to be sarcastic and make fun of people in that setting. And so we kind of stay off to the side, and that's what we do. And we begin to... I began to just try to explain to her our faith and begin to walk with her. She had a daughter named Mackenzie, and so we would go watch her daughter for her. Some of my friends would watch her daughter where she went and worked and did those kind of things. She was, she was just, her life was a wreck. I don't know how else to explain it besides her life was a wreck. And I had a good friend of mine who was in a band who was leading worship for a deal and playing a concert about an hour outside of Abilene, an hour and a half outside of Abilene. And so I invited her because I'm going, oh, what a great, she can kind of see what this is and see, you know, meet my friends. We have a great chance to, you know, I'm hoping maybe the guy will preach really well and I could talk to her about it on the way home. And, you know, this is my plan. And we get there and Robbie plays, who's my friend. And then I start to go, oh, no, we're in trouble here, because it was a True Love Waits deal. So here I have my lost friend who already has a daughter. She was actually dating a married man at the time, and I'm at a True Love Waits rally. And so I'm still hoping, okay, you know, I'm going to trust you, God, I'm going to trust you. And the speaker got up, and he started his talk by pulling out this red rose, and he's smelling it, and he's talking about how beautiful the rose is. And then he goes, in fact, I need to, you know, there's like 1,000 teenagers in the room. So he goes, okay, you've got to smell this. I mean, you've got to smell this. You've got to feel how just smooth the petals are. So he throws the rose out into the crowd, and then he goes on with his talk, which, honestly, even before I knew where the rose story was going, was horrible. It was fear-based. It was, do you want herpes? Of course you don't want herpes. You know how many kids get herpes from... It was that. It was fear-mongering. No setting the table of this is what sex is biblically. No. He was a hack. I don't know how else to say it. So near the end of his talk, he goes, where's my rose? Where's my rose? You know, some kid in the back left, like, and they runs it up and gives it to him. Well, the stem's broken. It's broken in half. There's barely any petals on it. And his big crescendo, his big thing was, now who would want this? Who would want this rose? And so when I tell the story, I'm saying that I felt so much rage in that moment. I mean, I just couldn't explain how angry, I probably would have verbally assaulted him if I could have got anywhere near him. And so then my mind just switches to, honestly, in that moment I go, if this is the game I can't play, I'm out. And so I'm going, my ministry lies outside of the church, not inside of the church. Because I can't even bring people I'm sharing the gospel. Because how confusing is it now that I've sat down for 4 months and gone, this is the gospel. This, and she shows up and here. Because I understand his point. I understand his point. But at some point, the gospel has to be the thing that sets up sex too.
Yeah.
Who would want the rose? Jesus wants the rose, you idiot. That's who wants the rose. The whole point of our message is that Jesus wants the rose, not who would want the rose. So this was one event in about 50. You know, from sitting in a theological class, sitting in a ministry class and hearing the young guys who are training to be pastors say, I won't marry someone who's not a virgin. From that, to the rose story, to the on and on I could go. Just this real clear, I have, and maybe I'm being harsh. If I'm being harsh, okay. I just kept wondering, no one understands the gospel anymore. That's what I felt like in Abilene. Yeah. A great bulk of the time I went, there is morality and there's arrogance and there's no understanding of what the gospel of Jesus Christ is and who it's for. And so there was no understanding that Jesus actually, when he wanted to convey the gospel, most of the time went after the religious and the righteous, not my friend Kim. And so how we came to trying to get the gospel across by attacking the sinner versus the righteous that needs to repent, it was just baffling. I just didn't understand it. And so that's the rose story. And if it wasn't for David McQueen at Beltway Park, I'm not sitting at this table with you, because I was done at that moment. Like, I left there going, okay, I'm done. So that's the rose story.
Oh, Matt, there's much more we could talk about. We could just not go see beautiful Sydney and sit in here and do interviews all day, but I don't think that would be a good use of the time. This has been edifying, brother. Anything else you particularly want to say to pastors out there in Nine Marks land, listening on radio sets across the country?
Well, I'll tell John and the four others that are listening. I think it's what you said. No, I mean, I can say this. I am not... I'm excited about what I see happening.
Me too.
I'm not a pessimist for all the... Because, you know, we're in Reformed circles. And, you know, the Reformed community, they're just so, oh, God, nobody knows their Bible and everything's collapsing. But everywhere I look, I just see young, sharp, godly Bible-preaching men. And maybe... Now, there's a lot of silliness out there. But here's the thing. There'll always be a lot of silliness out there. And there has always been a lot of silliness out there. But there seems to be a real stirring... and a real attraction to word-based, biblical preaching, exegetical, even in topical preaching, I've started to notice just strong exegesis. So it's, I'm excited about where I see things going right now. And so we'll have to let it play out, of course, but I'm excited about what God's doing and how he's raising things up and what are some of the popular books now and that's really exciting to me.
I almost always ask, any book recommendations? Last thing, any book recommendations for pastors? You got try reading this one or two, a classic or a new thing, anything.
Oh, man, I don't know. That's hard for me. I'm a little bit of a... you know, I like to read really good books, and then I like spiritual roughage at times too. And so I don't like to recommend spiritual roughage because I don't know. So I think most of the books I would recommend, I think that your listeners will have grasped, and you know,
or John Rutt.
Or John Rutt, or Carson, or those guys are brilliant men. They're gifts to us right now. Gifts to us. So,
man, thanks for the gift of this time, brother.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Enjoyed it. Thanks, Mark.
See ya. Mm-hmm.
To learn more about 9 Marks, visit our website, www.9marks.org. There you'll find articles, a blog called Church Matters, book reviews, tutorials, audio resources, and information about upcoming 9 Marks events. When you visit 9marks.org, be sure to sign up for our free 9 Marks e-journal. Again, the web address is www.9marks.org.